Accession number 9168, roll number 11.
Mr. Amat, reel 11.
Yeah. After 5 days and five nights, on the morning of the sixth morning, we woke up to find that we were sailing into the harbour at Gibraltar. And it's quite a sight to see this huge rock rising out of the sea that had been a British fortress for all those years. But we weren't allowed ashore, and we only stopped for about a couple of hours, just enough to pick up the mail. Well, the mail was brought out to us by a tender from the shore and hauled on board by the sailors. And by the way, the sailors on this particular ship were nearly all Lascars. That's sort of half-caste Indians that were employed in the merchant navy in those days with British officers. And anyway, I got a letter from my parents saying that that my ex-girlfriend's father had died, and that gave me an excuse to write, and I wrote and sent my condolences to her and all that. And I was later to receive a reply, and we kept corresponding all the time I was out abroad. We were then told to get into our tropical uniform, a drill uniform, and there was an awning stretched across the deck where the davits of the boats were held up, and because the sun came out and we experienced some of the better weather that was addicted to the Mediterranean. We set sail in the evening, and it was quite a pleasant journey after that, because we used to sit out in the sunshine and under the shade of these awnings during the day. Had very little to do except whatever guard duties were done. And one thing I remember is one of the relaxations of the soldier in those days was what we called housey-housey, what they called, what do you call it now?
Bingo.
Bingo. That was the only game a soldier was allowed to play and gamble money. You weren't allowed to gamble in the army, especially the regular army, and if you were caught, you were strictly dealt with. And what another game they used to play with the stokers on this ship were nearly all British, but the seamen and the people who'd done the watches and done all the deck work and all that, polished the rails and all that, were all Lascars. But the stokers used to get in some secluded corridors with their crown and anchor boards. And these weren't a board at all. It was a roll of canvas on which was painted, divided into six parts. And on there was the aces of a pack of cards, and a king and an anchor on the other two. What you had to do was three dice were used, which the man who was running the show used to throw. And before he threw, you had to put your money on whichever one of these six squares you thought would come up when he threw the dice. And it was a rare game, and quite a lot of money used to pass hands in those days, but it was illegal. And there was always somebody put on watch to make sure that when the red caps, who were always on these troop ships, came round, they didn't catch you. And what they used to do was the chap who was on watch at one of the end of the corridor would give the signal, and there'd be a scramble, and all the money was quickly put away, and the roll of canvas where the crown and anchor was on was rolled up and tucked away somewhere out of sight, and they all sort of stood around as if there was nothing wrong at all. But that's one of the things I remember. Another thing is, I was very keen on knowing where I was going and looking at the landscape, and I noticed on the right, as we went through the Mediterranean, we passed through what I thought was Morocco, and then Tunis, and I asked one of the officers, and he confirmed that I was right in the my view of the passing scenery. I mean, after quite a number of days, must have been about a week, I suppose, we got to Port Said, and one morning, I remember I woke up and the sun was shining, and in the distance I could see the minarets and the towers of this eastern city, which was quite a sight, really. And as we neared the harbour, crowds of boats, they called them bum boats in those days, of a small type of rowing boat or canoe, and these were brought out by the native Arabs with all their produce on for selling to the troops. There was Jaffa oranges, large sugar melons, and all sorts of clothing, like vests and shorts of calico and linen and all sorts of things like that. And also mementos and things like that for soldiers to buy, take home as souvenirs. And these people were shouting and making signs to the chaps on board as we tied up. And what they used to do with these men in these boats, they'd throw a line up over the rail, and if you caught it and pulled up, at the end of the line was a small basket, and into there you had to drop your money and ask the whatever you wanted down below the man, which if you wanted oranges you'd ask for them, put the money in and drop the basket down, and he'd take the money out and put the oranges in, and you'd put it up again and so on. And that was going on for a long while afterwards. Anyway, these were cleared away before noon, and the order went round that the ship was going to be what they call cold. In those days, all ships, warships and merchant ships, were all used coal. Very few, only the latest warships used oil, as they did later on, and it was all coaling. This was a coaling station. We'd already sailed and used up nearly all the coal in the ship, and we had to get a new supply on. And we were asked if we wanted to go on leave and visit the town for so many hours during the time this coaling was going on, because as I found out afterwards, it was a very dirty procedure. A lot of the company of the troops took passes and went out, but I stopped in and started writing letters. I didn't particularly wanted to go out. By the way, whilst we was on this trooper, there was officers and their wives, as well as the troops on this boat, and nearly all of them took advantage of the leave of absence to get away from the ship, because I expect some of them had travelled before. Anyway, what happened is the large doors at the side of the ship were flung open, planks were put across from the shore, and I noticed we were alongside a large dump of coal, and then I saw an army of women, only half dressed, absolutely nothing on above their waist, with their baskets, shallow baskets, wicker baskets, and these were being filled up by the men on the dump, and they kept these women and girls carried these baskets on their heads up the planks and dumped them in the hold of the ship, which held the coal. This went on for about 4 hours, and the dust and stench of the coal dust was terrific. Got into everybody's air and clothes and down your lungs as well, I expect. Anyway, we cleared it, and then the sailors come on, the Lascars, with their hose pipes, washed it all down, put the thing, the ship back into normal routine. And then the I experienced then the what the canal, how it had been held before by the French, because the French people were quite a lot about. There was the pilot who was going to escort us down the, or rather steer the ship down the canal. He was French. There was a searchlight, a large searchlight put on board, and this was manned by Frenchmen. You can tell by their speech that they were French, and at night, somewhere about 9 o'clock, I suppose it must have been, the searchlight was switched on, and the engine started, and we got underway, and sailed through the canal. It was quite an experience, really, because whilst we were going along with a searchlight playing on the banks, you could see all the little villages and the hutments where the natives, Arabs, used to be, and then there was the Arab dhows, the boats going up and down the canal with their sails spread for whatever wind they could catch. There was also convoys of camel trains going along, and the tail of each camel was tied to the harness, the head harness of the camel behind, and so there was a long line of camels all following one another, with an Arab sitting on the leading camel, and all the others were loaded up with various bundles and things. We arrived at Port Suez early in the morning, actually, and tied up there, and got rid of the unloaded the searchlight, and eventually got underway and pushed out into the past Aden, into the Red Sea. And I've often wondered why the sea was called red, but I realised that afterwards, because the actual colour of the sea is red. I forget now what the reason for this, but I believe it's something to do with the seaweed in that particular area. But the whole water is all reddish colour, whatever angle you looked at it. And as we passed through the Red Sea, I saw the first lot of flying fish. I'd heard about them and read about them, but I'd never seen them. But it's quite a sight to see these fish rise from the sea in groups and fly for several yards, and then hit the water again, nose first, and dive underneath, and then come up again at some other spot. Another thing I noticed whilst we were sailing through the Red Sea was the porpoises. Now these fish, I suppose they are fish, were huge things, about 14 foot long in some places. And they kept pace with the ship at the prow of the ship, at the front. If you looked over the side, you could see these huge things, especially at night, because they had a fluorescent glow with them. And they swam alongside, and I heard from one of these sailors that they always did this, and what they'd done was they picked up scraps that was dumped over the ship from time to time, from the cookhouse and all the various oddments that people discarded. And it was quite a sight, really. Anyway, I think we were 4 or 5 days in the Red Sea, and then we arrived at Bombay. And this is my first, well, one of the first tastes I had of the Orient, or the eastern part of the world. And it was different to the ports, say in Port Suez, in the fact that the buildings were completely different, and also the natives. Here in Bombay, the natives were all different types of Indian tribes, from their features and their build and all that. You could tell they were different altogether. And it was quite a experience to see the various people who used to earn a living meeting these ships as they came in and selling all sorts of things. And there was acrobats, jugglers, men with pipes sitting down cross-legged and making a cobra come up out of a basket after they were blowing a pipe. And then there was the mongoose killed the cobra. One of the natives was squat down with his sack, and in the sack was these cobras, snakes, and in the other one, in a basket, the side was a mongoose. And he'd be telling all sorts of things to gather the crowd round. When he got a crowd round, and he'd invite him to throw some money onto a piece of carpet. When he thought he'd got enough, he'd start the act. And it was quite enlightening, really. He'd play on this pipe, and these cobras, well, one of them had come out and raise its head and move its fangs about and its head back and forth, and then he suddenly released the mongoose, and the mongoose used to make one swift rush and go over the throat of the cobra and kill it straight away. And that was the sort of end of the show, and then he'd start off somewhere else, and all sorts of things were happening. Anyway, we were given 4 hours leave. Anybody who wanted to go into the town could, if they wanted to, and they get a pass to take with them. A lot of the chaps went. I never went at the time. I stuck with the other part of the unit alongside the quay, the harbour. Most of these chaps, by the way, went to a place called Grant Road, and this was similar to the place I was telling you about, Le Havre. It was supposed to be a diamond merchant's place, like Hatton Garden is in London, but there was also another activity there, and that was it was the red light district. And I heard all about it when these chaps come back from their little visitation. But anyway, it's just by the way. In the evening, we boarded a train. And there's another thing about this, is that the trains in India were run by the Indian Peninsula Railway. And this was a railway which was built up by the British years before. And nearly all the drivers and stokers were British, but all the other railway employees were sort of what we used to call half caste people, with descendants of all British regiments had gone through there, and the Indian population of various areas. And these were nearly all of this type of person that was employed on the railways. There were huge steam locomotives, and the carriages were rather unique and different from ordinary carriages in this part of the world, in Europe, in that the third class carriages, which were allotted to the native personnel, were all wooden seats, and no comfort at all, hardly. Just glass windows, and that's about all. But the second class, where British troops used to ride, they weren't allowed to ride in any other class, was all upholstered, and it was usually only four or five of you, or perhaps half a dozen if there was a overwhelming number, allotted to each compartment. And these compartments were, the back of each seat was upholstered, and if you pulled away from the bottom and hooked it onto two chains, it acted as a double bunk, so that there was room for four people to sleep in each compartment. Another thing about the train was the fact that the door had a special effect. If the light was on in the compartment and you opened the door, it would go out. And if it was out and you opened the door, it would come on. This was a device which was used to stop loose wallers, as they were called, breaking into any compartment and stealing any of your goods. And the door you could lock. Also, there were three different types of window fitted. One was glass, one was a sort of a slatted window, and the other one was a mosquito type of anti-mosquito type of thing, with a galvanised perforated metal screen which stopped any flies coming in during the heat of the day. Anyway, we rode all night on this train. By the way, those trains never used to go more than about 25 miles an hour, and then after 2 or 3 hours they'd stop, pull into a siding and stop there for 2 or 3 hours, then they'd come out and have another go. And we arrived, I think it was about 90 miles south of Bombay, at a camp called Dulali, and the troops used to call it Dulali, but the real name is Dulali. And here was an acclimatization camp. You had to stop here 2 or 3 weeks every draft to get you acclimatized to the tropical weather, hot sunshine and all that sort of thing. Whilst I was there, we were in tents. These tents weren't nothing like the old Army Bell. These were tropical tents with a lining inside each one, and each one was quite a big tent. And the floor, a wooden floor, and there were four beds on each side inside each one of these tents. And during the day, all the walls were all rolled up and tied up, so the tent was all you had was actually at the top, and this allowed plenty of ventilation during the heat of the day. Anyway, one thing amused me there was the kite hawks that used to fly around in groups or flocks of them overhead. And we used to have to go to the cookhouse to get our meals and bring them back to the tents where we used to sleep. And it's quite a sight, really, because being raw to that sort of life out there, where a lot of the chaps took their mess tins out, and they had perhaps a dinner in one and in the other lid. They'd have some bread and butter or something like that for their afters, and they walk along and back to the tent. But before they got anywhere near halfway, these hawks had dived down and scooped all their dinner up, or whatever they got in their mess tin. But we soon learnt to get over that. And we shielded all our mills. Used to probably take our helmets off for the little short journey and cover our mill before we got back to the tent. But then there was another incident that rather amused me, and that was in the morning, very early. We used to, because it used to get light very early out there in the tropics, well, it wasn't tropics, but hot weather, and there used to be a troop of monkeys, wild monkeys from the hills, used to come down, only very small creatures, about as big as a cat. And even before Reveille, you'd hear these screeching and chattering, and they'd swoop through the tents, whilst a pair member, some of them still asleep. And we used to have kit boxes in the front of our bed, where we used to keep our kit, and on top we'd put probably our mess tins and a bit of our equipment and all that sort of thing. And these monkeys used to come along and scoop all these equipment and mess tins all over the shop, and seemed to be playing a game of chase me all the way through the camp. And this used to happen almost every morning. And there was chaps used to throw boots at them and all sorts, and curse and swear them for waking them up. But anyway, it's quite an amusing incident. Then we